Thursday, the 21st day of April, 2005. It's now 8:39 a.m. Senator Huggins, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins, are here this morning. We're going to pick up where we left off yesterday with House Bill 136, and we have with Representative Roker's bill, and we have able staff on hand to walk us through the bill. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator, for hearing House Bill 136. For the record, I'm Heather Nabriga, staff to Representative Roker, and I apologize if he is not here today. He's stuck in a legislative council meeting this morning. Before you have House Bill 136, and while it looks long, it actually just does three simple things. The first thing it does is require that the minimum fines we have imposed in the statutes for DUIs are actually imposed by the courts. That hasn't actually been in the statutes, and therefore some judges have felt they had discretion to actually waive the minimum fines or decrease the minimum fines by a certain amount. So we're clarifying that it is the legislature's intent when we set the minimum fines in statute, we mean the minimum fines. The second thing it does on page 4 of the bill, section 3, is we are increasing the amount of minimum fines that can be waived for successful graduates of therapeutic courts. Right now the judges can waive 50% of their minimum fines if they're a successful graduate. We're increasing it to 75%. We're also expanding the therapeutic courts to felony DUI cases, so allowing these therapeutic courts that are set out here in statute to be applied in felony cases. And that's basically what House Bill 136 does. I'd be happy to answer your questions, but I do have Judge Wanamaker online, who is an expert in this area and would be a great resource for you guys to ask questions if you are so inclined.
I'm Judge Wanamaker here. Hello?
Yeah, we'll be with you in just one moment, Jim.
All right.
Senator Huggins, you had a question for
yes,
Heather?
Yes, the felony portion.
Yes.
Where is that located?
Page 4, line 14, is actually just adding that reference to N1.
Got
is
it.
Actually
Got
referring
it.
To the. I know it's kind of confusing. It's actually just that little tiny section allows the felonies to be added.
Got it. Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions for Heather? Seeing none, Mr. Wanamaker, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. If you'll put yourself on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Longer for soaking up public resources to handle his jail time and handle the side other problems from his addiction to alcohol. And the highways are safer. Everybody wins under this model. That's about it in a nutshell. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Wanamaker? Seeing none, we appreciate your being with us this morning, Jim. Thank you very much. Heather, I have a question. As I look at this section on page 2 regarding minimum fines, currently I see courts imposing fines of saying 30 days, 20 days suspended, $1,000 fine, $800 suspended. Would this stop the suspension of those sentences?
Mr. Chairman, the courts now have to impose, to, if you see right above the pay of the minimum fine, it says they have to serve the minimum imprisonment. So courts often, for a first DUI, your sentence is 72 hours. That's the minimum. Courts will often impose the 33 days and suppose 30, and suspend 30. So technically, they are serving the minimum, but they have this bigger sentence hanging out there in case they violate their probation. Courts now are also doing the same with the fines. Some judges believe that the minimums are the minimum, so they'll impose $3,000 but suspend $1,500, imposing the minimum, which is $1,500 now. What we would do is this would allow courts to do basically the same thing, but they can't suspend below the minimum. So judges often will give bigger sentences than the minimum but suspend up to that minimum portion. So therefore, if you reoffend on your probation, that bigger sentence goes back into effect.
Okay.
But it would not allow the judges to suspend below the minimum set out in statute.
All right.
To answer your question.
Thank you. Question? Other questions? Senator French?
I'm not sure if Heather's the better person to ask, or perhaps you, Judge Wanamaker, but I'm just kind of curious about the interplay between the sections designed to make certain that the minimum fine is imposed, and let's just take a first offender DWI so we can all talk about the same amount, and that's that $1,500 minimum fine. The law that we're changing is going to make certain that everybody convicted of first offense DWI pays a $1,500 fine. And yet at the end of the bill, we're giving the court the opportunity to suspend up to 75% of the minimum fine upon completion of the wellness court. And so I guess I'm just kind of trying to figure out how you can impose the first part of the bill says you can't impose suspended time unless you've mandated the payment of that minimum fine. Are you envisioning that you collect the fine up front and then pay it back to the defendant upon completion, or what mechanism do you see, or maybe Heather, you can tell me what mechanism the sponsor sees for this process?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer that question. I'm sure Judge Wanamaker would like to chime in. We find the reason we suspend the portions of the fines for therapeutic court graduates is that is a carrot for them as they go through the system. When they participate in these therapeutic court programs, which are 18-month-long programs, they have to pay for every aspect of the program. They have to pay for their treatment. They have to pay for their electronic monitoring. They actually pay quite a bit of expenses. So in order for them to have an incentive to go into the therapeutic court program, we have these carrots, and one is waiving part of their minimum sentence, and the other was waiving part of the minimum fine. So it's a juxtaposition of imposing the minimum fines have to be imposed in order for these carrots to actually be effective. And so what we're doing is allowing the judges these carrots of waiving part of their minimum fines and sentences in order that they entice people to come into these courts, and these people will have to pay quite a bit of money as they're in these therapeutic programs. And Judge Wanamaker, I'm sure, can elaborate better than I can.
Mr. Wanamaker, did you have any comments?
No, I think that's accurate. In the therapeutic court method, the defendant pleads guilty at the start of the 18-month program. He's found guilty, but the actual sentencing doesn't happen until 18 months later when he graduates. And at that time, the judge can, with the minimum fine, can go down to, from what it was before to 25% of what it was. It's a reward for getting
Senator French?
Judge Wanamaker, just so we all know, the defendant pleads guilty, he's found guilty, and so were he to fall off the wagon, so to speak, and get arrested for another DWI, that would certainly be a second DWI and not a simultaneous first.
Right, exactly. And that's why we find him guilty right at day one.
But there's no requirement that they actually come out of pocket with the fine money at that time, because the idea is that they're going to need the money for wellness court.
Yeah, they're shelling out every dollar they can earn for treatment, and naltrexone, and their other expenses.
Well, last question. I don't want to belabor this, but it seems like you kind of have a pretty good system in place for doing this. I'm not sure then why we're sort of strengthening the fine aspect. Are these just separate ideas that happen to be in the same bill?
Right. Yeah, through the chair, that's an accurate evaluation, and the you know, firming it up that they must pay the minimum fine, it deals with the vast population of DUI offenders, and think of the people in the therapeutic courts as a small subset of that.
And I guess I wasn't aware of judges trying to get around those fines, but I'll take the word of the sponsor, and there's someone here who looks knowledgeable, nodding their head, that says this is happening. Are you aware of that, Judge, of judges?
No, it certainly wasn't my practice, and it's minimum to me. I think it was the Anchorage practice to pretty clearly observe that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Heather, the people that are going through the therapeutic court process, and you said it would be a substantial amount of money. What if they do not have the wherewithal to pay that? What? Just for information, Judge Wanamaker, what's roughly the total cost for the 18-month period?
We tabulated that $1,003, I believe it was, and at that time, the total in public and private money was around $7,000, and the defendant himself paid $4,000 of that.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? We have one other person who wants to testify, Wendy Hamilton. Wendy, if you'll come up and put your name on the record for us, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you. My name is Wendy Hamilton. I'm the Juno Therapeutic Court Coordinator. I'm employed by the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, who wrote the grant for the Juno Therapeutic Court, different than some of the other courts in the state as far as funding. Our court is going to be a misdemeanor felony court. It's often the felony person who is most motivated to do therapeutic court. In the last quarter alone in Juno, there was 10 felonies. So there's a large population there that could benefit from this program. It has been somewhat of a common practice for judges, if they don't think the defendant can pay any of the fine, the old concept, you can't get blood from a turnip, they suspend quite a bit of that $10,000 minimum fine on a first-time felony. If we're going to have a carrot of a 75% reduction in fine for Bill over here, but he sees John over here getting 100% suspended, and he's not doing therapeutic court, then that really takes away one of the main carrots. We'd like to think that people come into therapeutic court with, you know, a lot of cheer and yay, I want to do this and get better. But, and that is part of it, but part of the reality is we do need to have incentives to say to someone, you know, this is an 18-month program, but it's going to change your life. So don't just go do your time, change your life. But you have to offer incentives. And so Juno Therapeutic Court strongly supports this bill, and it would really help us operate better as a court if we could be misdemeanor and felony and had those carrots. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Ms. Hamilton?
Ms. Hamilton.
Senator French.
I just want to remind the committee the long-term consequences of the completion of the program. The completion of the therapeutic court doesn't undo your conviction. It just simply allows you to avoid some of the more negative consequences of long-term incarceration. Maybe you'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Well, the person pleads guilty, so it is on their record. It never goes away. It's never expunged. It's not dismissed. It's there. So what was the right?
The benefit to the person, I mean, what benefit does the person get having pled guilty to the crime up front? What do they get out of therapeutic?
Well, the chronic alcoholic gets a chance to be in recovery, to be supported for 18 months. It's showing that treatment works, but the longer the treatment, the better. And most people go for 30 days, and then they sort of, if they go inpatient, and then they sort of phase out. Maybe they'll do another 30 days of aftercare. The chronic alcoholic, actually 2 years would be even better, but 18 months is the statutory amount here in Alaska. And in Washington, they have a 2-year deferred sentencing program where you're in counseling for 2 years before you get it, your benefits. What therapeutic courts do is they have the power of the court, which is, you know, sort of the hammer over the head, you know, that if you drop out, you're going to get your full sentence, and the power of treatment. So those two things work together. We have the impetus through the court for the person to stay in treatment. Now, that is very powerful in about the first 6 months when the person is getting sober, they're sort of like waking up, looking at their life, going, oh my God, high relapse rate first 6 months. But then their life starts to change. And that's why I have this job, because that's when things get incredible. Because people start getting self-esteem. They have a job. Their family starts being reunited. They come to the court on a weekly basis at first, stand in front of the judge, and says, you know, I had a little rough time this week, but such and such, I'm doing well. The court applauds him, stands up and applauds him. Now, these people have never been applauded in a courtroom before in their lives. They support each other. It's a support group for themselves. They work very hard. But after 18 months, you know, we should take before and after shots. It's just incredible. These people change their lives. The benefit to the public, of course, is that you've got one less drunk driver on the road.
Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wendy, I read recently, I think it was an email that's out on, there's some implication for DUI conviction when you cross the border into Canada. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of that?
Oh, boy, I, through the chair, I can only tell you what I, this isn't fact, but what I do know is that Canada is tightening up on their borders. And if you have any crime, not just DUI, any crime, they are not letting you go through. Now, I'm not sure, I've heard that if it's like a first-time DUI, you might be able to pay a huge fine just to go through Canada. I have a friend who had several DUIs in the past. She's been sober for 8 years. She's off probation, doing great. For her to get through Canada now, she has to apply. She has to send to the Canadian government, get an application. She has to have 3 letters of reference that attest to her rehabilitation and recovery. And then they'll think about letting her cross into Canada. So it has gotten, Canada's really tightened down, but it isn't just DUI.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Hamilton. Appreciate
Thank you.
You being here today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, we've gone through the bill. Are there questions on the bill? Does Department of Law have any comment on the bill? Thank you. One of the things that is very interesting to me is, as I've been watching to try to find out, okay, what is the standard sentence for someone who's arrested for driving under the influence? It seems to be that certain courts in certain parts of the state almost have a recurring theme. Suspension of sentence seems to be a fairly common occurrence. And when I started looking into that myself to find out why, it came down to the fact that you can't get blood out of a turnip in many cases, but that you can hold something over their head if they reoffend. And that seems to be almost a common approach in many of the courts. So that's a tough one. I not want to be soft on those people who are endangering my lives and the lives of my family and my friends and their families. But I also see a trend where people facing large fines and prison sentences try real hard to reach plea agreements for other offenses. And because of the time that the court has and the limited resources that the prosecution has, I've seen an awful lot of those cases that would be driving under the influence that have been led down to negligent driving or reckless driving, something that didn't have an impact. On the Canadian side, Senator, I do serve as a co-chairman of a committee with the along with some Canadian people as well, where we are looking at that issue. And the problem with Canada is that they consider driving under the influence what they call a classified crime, which would be, we'd call it a felony. And so they don't allow people with felony convictions to enter into Canada without quite some procedures. And on the other hand, Canada considers to be, or at least in British Columbia, for an example, they consider possession of marijuana to be a minor crime, where we consider it to be a major crime, and we won't let their people cross our border, even though either one of those people may not be a threat to the safety and security of the other country. We're doing that, and the Penoir Group is working on that right now, and we're working with the Canadian government, we're working with the U.S. government to try to find some way that when someone no longer is a threat to society, that they don't get unnecessary restrictions crossing the international border. So I think one of there's a lot of people that live in Alaska will do almost anything they can to keep that conviction off of their record because there are some other problems and ramifications that go with that. So that kind of leads the district attorney's office to, with a huge workload, to maybe get some people out there that should have been convicted of driving under the influence that don't have anything like that on their record because of how they're facing that. So while we're being tough, we may be creating an unintended consequence at the same time, which means that we have people that are driving who should have been convicted for driving under the influence that now are convicted or pled guilty to a different crime so that it doesn't look that way on their record. And it's a tough question. We do have one more person who just came online to testify from Fairbanks, Teresa Thompson. Teresa, are you with us this morning?
I am.
If you'll put yourself on the record for us, we're eager to hear your testimony. Okay, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Okay. A United Way of the Tama Valley supports House Bill 136 because we're happy that it will expand the wellness court and to felony DUI defendants. United Way conducted a community needs assessment back in 2001 and identified five priority needs not being adequately addressed in Fairbanks. and one of those is substance abuse. And as a result, United Way has embarked upon an anti-substance abuse campaign using social marketing to target adolescents and young adults to reduce alcohol and drug abuse in our community. And we received a federal drug-free community support grant of $100,000 back in September of 2004. And we're hopefully going to be receiving future grants for more years. And part of the requirement of this grant is to utilize multiple strategies across multiple sectors to combat substance abuse. And United Way supports the therapeutic court model in Fairbanks. And as you know, we don't have that yet in Fairbanks. And including the felony DUI defendant as one of those strategies is going to affect change in substance abuse in Fairbanks. So we really support this bill and hope that it moves forward.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Thompson? Thank you very much for being with us this morning. We appreciate your help.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. Other questions? Any other comments on the bill? Senator Huggins?
For Ms. Hamilton, the grant that's supporting the program for those, for the most part, how long is the grant for?
The United Way grant?
No, I'm sorry, ma'am. Talking to a young lady here in the forum.
Oh, sorry.
Different grant, but thank you.
Through the chair, the current grant is for 3 years. It's a National Highway Safety Transportation Administration grant, NHTSA grant, which is also the grant monies, which is starting the court in Ketchikan and Fairbanks. It's a three-year grant with a strong possibility of a renewal for another 3 years. NHTSA is, this is their approach to fighting the drunk driving deaths and drunk driving in general, because therapeutic courts work. So they've put a large amount of money in the state of Alaska and nationwide into this. So we have, although we are going to, in the second and third year, we have to start requiring matching funds. So we're a little bit worried about that, but not too much yet. But we are going to have to start having some matching funds in the second and third year.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think most of us recognize the merit of the program. The amount for Juneau is, because you're responsible for the Juneau area as far as the
actually,
grant, right?
Matt Felix, the director of National Council on
Roughly
Alcohol,
the macro
about 300,000.
About 300,000. Do you know what it is across the state?
For NHTSA money,
yeah,
total?
Right. Yeah.
I don't. No, Robin Johnson, the therapeutic court coordinator, would know that. Yeah.
Yeah. The only reason I mention that is I see it, we have zero fiscal note, and though it may be an interim zero fiscal note, long term it may be a different impact, just for information so we know what we're requesting.
Possibly Judge Wanamaker would have a comment on that. I don't know.
Yeah, Jim Wanamaker here. Am I on?
Sure. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. Actually, I'm on a national committee of judges that have on these type of courts across the country, and it's a partnership of the National Drug Court Association and National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And in a short sentence, NHTSA is actively pushing federal money down to the states to help build these kind of courts. And so there's lots of money available. Also, in the current Secure Surface Transportation Act, the version that in Congress, the version that's been passed by the House, makes these type of courts an authorized expenditure from a $630 million fund, and the Senate version goes farther. The version that's going forward in Senator Stevens' committee would require states to do something in this area and supply funding. So there's a huge momentum from the federal government. And up to this point, there's been a lot of money available through the traffic safety director there in Juneau, Don Smith, in the discretionary account. And that's been at least $1 million so far. So it's an opportune time to get going on these kinds of programs. And what happens is, last one out when funds come short. So it seems to be the first one through the door.
Thank you, Judge Wanamaker. Appreciate that very much.
All right, go ahead. I was just checking with clerk. This bill has a finance referral after we're done with it. Okay. Want to make sure. I was reading through the fiscal notes, and I just noticed that the Department of Law says, well, it might not have much effect, but then they said it might have a big effect. So not being able to analyze that too well. And one of the comments in the fiscal note number 6 is similar to what I think I found in my earlier investigation, that this could lead to more trials, which if we're willing to do that, that's not a problem, but you're going to end up with people who can't afford the fine, who have a public defender saying, I can't afford the fine, I want to go to trial. And so you may get to that, where you can't use the suspended sentence to the effect that it's done now. Want to make sure that we're aware of that fact. Again, it's a very tough situation because you don't want to be soft on someone who's driving all intoxicated. You have to take a look at the fiscal impact, which is a responsibility of the Finance Committee. Okay, any other questions? All right. Any discussion among the members?
Seems like a good bill, Mr.
Thoughts
Chairman.
Thoughts on the bills?
Good bill. I took a moment to review some of the material supplied by the sponsor and found to my surprise that there are judges in Juneau and Nome that are both suspending fines well below the minimum. That is, imposing a fine and suspending a large amount to get around what I thought was a pretty clear provision of law that you get a certain amount of fine imposed for each level of DWI. So it's not been a problem where I practice in Anchorage, but I see it's an issue here and in other parts of the state.
Other questions? Will of the committee on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 136 with individual comments and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, this bill is moved to the next committee. We'll take about a 3-minute recess. We're back on the record. We have Representative Stoltz with us this morning, and we're going to do something a little unusual, but I think the chairman has the leeway to do unusual things from time to time. We have two bills of Mr. Stoltz's that are on our calendar, House Bill 131 and 132. And we're going to ask Representative Stoltz to introduce both of those bills to us at one time so he can attend to other business and we'll be able to work with his staff afterwards. Mr. Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure, my first time here this year, and I appreciate the opportunity to present both these. They both have a common feature in that they're introduced a desire to help protect Alaska seniors from a growing, targeting of them as by fraudulent means. And House Bill 131 deals with access to theft, certainly not limited to seniors, but it's been a growing area of crime against seniors, and that population group is more vulnerable than others. The offense isn't, and the amount of money lost isn't nearly as devastating as the loss of your identity and trying to restore your record. I know people of my parents' generation and I say this guardedly, of Senator Seekins' generation as well, very jealously guard their good reputation and their credit. And My folks always paid their bills, and I think most of our parents have that same ethic. And when their credit rating is devastated, just the trauma on it, I think it elevates it to part of it. It's Senator French knows from being the prosecutorial side, having this elevated to a felony, it increases the chance of prosecution. Police are less likely to seriously pursue something that I think the term that was used in some of the testimony, and I think it was more out of frustration with some of these crimes are blown off, but it's not intentionally, but it just happens in an overworked system. This is trying to recognize this offense for the seriousness, and I think it's only going to get more serious. I got two very capable guys that are going to present this in probably more intelligible detail. But, the other is House Bill 132. It's a crime against the elderly bill, and it's increasing the if the offense against a person elderly and that's defined as 65 or older is committed against that person with reckless disregard for the fact, you know. And really, it's meant folks that are targeting seniors because of perceived vulnerability. It's my policy call, and I hope the legislature will adopt it, and it's support of the administration to recognize crimes against that target that class of Alaskans is elevated to a higher penalty. It's a pretty high standard to prove. We've all heard the egregious cases. I remember one particular case, and I'm glad it never ended the end. There was I ran into a lady I've known most of my life going into the bank, and she said she was real excited. She was going to get some money out of the bank to pay the she had won this Canadian lottery, and it was all she had to do was pay the Canadian taxes and send the money. I begged her to go talk to her son, and she did, and at least I think she did. But those types of things, it just it's been one of my passions working with seniors, and it's I guess I have folks that target people at either end of the spectrum, whether it's children or seniors or the handicapped. I think it warrants a special elevation of protection, and it's I guess this is my I really want to. Thank the Department of Law because they've really brought these issues to me and gave me the opportunity to present a couple of bills that I feel pretty strongly about. The feedback I've gotten from my community, both seniors alike, it's fairly supportive, and you're going to hear from a lot of groups that support this legislation. It's the House Judiciary Committee and the Finance Committee on the other side worked fairly hard on trying to hone some of the problems, and as you see any technical changes, I welcome the ability of the Department of Law, who's going to be here to work with anything that you see that might help make these bills more effective. But I think there's been a lot of effective work done on them already.
Stoltz, I take offense at calling people in their 60s elderly. Those are people that are somewhere in their 80s.
I think the bill defines it as 65.
Yeah.
Still might be a majority of the Senate, but.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I use that term advisedly, as I said.
You could be calling a majority of the Senate elderly.
I do so with.
Therefore, your attacks on our bills could be considered to be felony.
And, Mr. Chairman, I don't think any of the members of the Senate need any protection. I think we might need a protection bill from you.
Oh, I see. Okay. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would just like to say thanks to Representative Stoltz. I know from experience in going to senior center with him that, number one, he knows everybody there by first name and some of their dogs, and his mother's there. And my assumption, Bill, is that, you know, you have had more than a little bit of conference with people at the senior center there in the Chugiak area on this. But I just say thanks to you for doing this because you're right. It's a group of people that are great Americans and our generation has done great things for our country, but they're entering into an area or an era of vulnerability based on age and naivety and a whole bunch of other things. But equally important, there's this huge surge of people that relatively sophisticated in their approach to exploiting that group. So I say thank you to you for that.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to close. Not just to protect myself from attacking the Senate, but I don't think there's necessarily any mental infirmity that's created because of age. There's certainly more than a few can more than hold on with me, but I think there's a demonstrated group of folks in the elderly class that are targeted and we're seeing as people live longer I've just seen how devastated older people have been. One of my neighbors through a different theft in the mailbox, this has been over a year and a half ago, and she's still sorting through trying to restore her life. And again, it's one of my friends who's probably in her mid to late 60s. I would never call her elderly, because she's feistier than I am. I really use the term elderly advisedly, knowing the folks that I know. Some of my most vigorous friends. I have an uncle who just quit downhill skiing when he was 90 because he was starting to slow down. So,
feistiness doesn't seem to decline with age.
Pardon?
Feistiness doesn't seem to decline with age. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Chair Seekins. Representative Stoltz has only a little bit to do with this bill. Do we have penalties in a similar sense for the mentally disabled? We talked about children and this part, and there's that group as well. Do you know if we do?
No, I don't know. I bet you Randy Raro could probably delve into that. But I would hope we do. But, other family connections with that issue, and a lot of have the same type of disgust for anybody who targets that group.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Randy.
Okay. So, Representative Stoltz, we appreciate your being here to introduce these bills for us, and we'll let you turn it over to your
capable
A-team. Who would you like to have first on your A-team?
Well, Mr. Raro and Ben Mulligan, they've been carrying the bill.
Gentlemen, there's two seats there. Why don't you come on up, and
thanks, Bill.
We'll see what we can do to get to the meat of this bill. We'll start with 131. And who would like to lead off?
I can, Mr. Chairman.
Pull that around, Randy. It's kind of a directional mic.
Right. Yeah,
thank you.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Randy Raro, and I am an attorney with the Department of Law. The Criminal Division does support HB 131. Identity theft's a growing problem in this state, and I think District Attorney Skidmore may be on the line for any technical questions. He can probably answer those a little better than I can. But Criminal Division does support the bill, and I'll try to answer any questions committee has.
Questions? Senator Guest?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy, access device, that's defined somewhere. I didn't see it in the bill. It's defined in statute somewhere.
Through the chair, Senator Guest, it is defined, I think, in 1181-900.
I actually keep a copy of 1181-900 in my. So.
That's a good idea.
It's. I notice that I need it quite often.
Can we get that on the record? Is someone going to read it into the record?
He'll read it on the record.
Through the chair, it's defined in 1181-900-B1. Access device means a card, comma, credit card, plate, code, account number, algorithm, or identification number, including a social security number. Electronic serial number or password that is capable of being used alone or in conjunction with another access device or identification document to obtain property or services, or that can be used to initiate a transfer of property.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Guest.
Randy, I notice that we have zero fiscal notes, which seems like every tough on crime bill has zero fiscal notes. Are we going to be able to prosecute more people under this? I mean, is this going to actually do something, I guess, because you have zero fiscal notes and then you have.
Through the chair, Senator Guest, I think the bill will accomplish something. Even though there is a zero fiscal note, the bill actually is elevating, current crimes that are on the books, so these people would be, charged, I guess, possibly anyway at a lower level, but it is elevating, the crime. So, some resources, I guess, are currently dedicated to the effort.
Thank you.
Other questions? So far? Okay. Senator French?
Thank you. Mr. Raro, maybe you could comment. I know there's one aspect of the bill that's been kicked around in committee and in the other body, and that's the dollar figure associated with the felony level. In most cases, you have to steal $500 or break $500 worth of property to be a felony because for a lot of reasons, resources, relative seriousness of the crime, and so forth. In this case, the level set at $50 could you comment on that and why that dollar figure was selected?
I can take a shot, but can we? Is it okay to check and just see if D.A. Skidmore is on the line? I think
yes. Mr. John? Skidmore's online. Mr. Skidmore, if you'll put yourself on the record for us this morning, then let me know if you heard Senator French's question.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is John Skidmore. I am the supervisor of the felony property unit in the Anchorage District Attorney's Office. I've been here for about 2 years as the supervisor and about a year and a half before that on the front lines of the property unit, and I've worked with the Department of Law for about 8 years in Dillingham, Kenai, Bethel, as well as Anchorage. I did hear Senator French's question, and through the chair, Senator French, the answer to your question is that when we looked at the dollar figures here, I would refer you to the crime of forgery in the second degree. That's also an identity theft type of crime where someone steals someone else's check, and it really doesn't matter if you wrote that check for 1 cent, $5, $10, or $100,000, it's still a Class C felony when you use someone else's check. And in the same light, what was done here is they said, for an access device, a credit card, that's the equivalent of being able to use someone's check in some fashion. Actually, in other fashions, it's even worse because it's capable of being used over and over and over again. $50, I can tell you, is about the median of what other states are doing as well. Some states set a zero level or a $0 level in terms of fraudulent use of an access device. Some set it at 50, some have it at 500, some have it more than us. 750 or more, but we chose 50 because we thought that was an appropriate level. It's still not quite on the level of forgery in the second degree where there's a $0 amount, but it certainly is a recognition that the use of the access device is a very serious and significant event, and because it's capable of being repeated over and over, I think that we chose to elect a lower dollar amount aim at prevention as much as we were at the mere punishment of the actual event here, but to prevent other uses of it.
Thank you for the questions. That the dollar, when I look at a credit card theft, for an example, the actual theft for the use may be $100, but the potential could be up to $10,000 while it's still in their possession or more. So, you know, in some respects, I don't have a problem when I'm looking at an access device. Doesn't necessarily, stealing it doesn't necessarily, you're only going to get, you could be getting only the value of the card, but what's the value contained in the card that's at risk there?
Senator.
Comment?
Chair, that's a good point, and I think what also played into it is the amount of time that it takes victims to recover from this particular type of theft crime. Hundreds of hours, you know, so the impact is greater than in this type of property crime.
Other questions from members? We have
on this bill or on the
on this bill?
Okay.
We're still there. We have Michelle Logan also online from the Anchorage Police Department. Michelle, did you want to testify on this?
Yes, I did. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And good morning to members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Detective Michelle Logan. I'm a detective with the Anchorage Police Department. I've been with the Anchorage Police Department for over 10 years. And for the last 3 years, I've been working as a detective in the fraud unit, specializing in the investigation and charging of financial crimes, including embezzlement, forgery, credit card fraud, and identity theft, both at the state and the federal level. And I'm here this morning via teleconference to support HB 131, Council 131. I don't have specific numbers, but I can say in the last 3 years, the identity theft reports have been increasing, and even when we don't maybe take a report, the calls that I receive that passed through the front counter of the Anchorage Police Department to my desk, where people are just calling with questions about what do I do. I've got my credit card statement. I've got charges on here I don't recognize, and I believe so-and-so may have had access to this. And these kinds of crimes are increasing ever more. As a police officer, we know that the identity theft aspect of this bill, which is not specifically an identity theft bill, but identity theft is perpetuated by find this morning. And as police officers, the most common access device crime that we see is the fraudulent use of a credit card. And I was glad to hear District Attorney John Skidmore talk about the difference in the dollar amount for to clarify why we're going with the $50 level. Because anymore, as checks are starting to lose some ground and people are more and more using their debit cards and their credit cards in order to get airline mileage, they're using these more and more to pay for items. And when the theft of a debit card or a credit card occurs, I believe they're much easier to use than an actual check, where you have to stand there and fill out the check in front of the cashier. They ask for ID, so you not only had to steal the check, but you have to have some kind of viable ID to show them as well. Whereas the debit cards or credit cards, and oftentimes debit cards can be run through as a charge, as a credit. They'll say debit or credit. And if it's credit, you don't have to put in a PIN number, so you don't necessarily have had to have stolen the PIN number. But by and large, I watch this in the stores, and they don't ask for ID when you're running through the credit cards. You can put your picture on the credit card and think, or put on the back, say, CID. In other words, instead of finding your name on the back of the card, it'll say, some people put CID, thinking that will help protect them. But I've seen cases where the credit card has a photograph of a white male on it, and a black female ran the credit card at a Fred Meyer or some other store and was actually able to use the credit card. So I think this bill is going to bring in line the seriousness of the offense online with what we already have for forgery. Both the forgery and the fraudulent use of an access device and obtaining an access device statutes that we have on the books right now were, I believe, in the Alaska statute since 1978. And an interesting thing I found in the comments regarding fraudulent use of an access device under section 1146-285 and 1146-290 was it said that they had a phrase in there, it is highly unlikely, and this is 1978, it is highly unlikely that the fraud will involve $25,000, so B felony provisions are not provided. Well, that was 1978, and today in 2005, easily someone could steal a credit card and run that card up to $25,000 or more. As a matter of fact, yesterday we arraigned a defendant here in Anchorage who had done just that. He had, over a three-month period, living with an elderly gentleman, had stolen or had intercepted the solicitation for credit card offers that had come in the mail, had filled them out using the elderly gentleman's information, and in a three-month period had run up over $34,000 in credit card charges. So, and every time he swiped the card, very rarely was the charge that he swiped over $500. So when these credit cards are being stolen, they'll go into a store and they'll swipe it, you know, 100, 200, 300, but it's very seldom that the swipe, the dollar amount is over 500. But I think with this $50 limit, that it's going to bring this more online with what it should be. So that's all I have for 131. I'll hopefully be able to speak again and more about that particular incident with the elderly gentleman when we discuss House Bill 132. So that's all I have this morning. I appreciate the opportunity, unless there's any questions.
Any questions?
Briefly.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, either for you, Officer Logan, or for you, Mr. Skidmore, if you're still on the line. Is a bank check an access device?
Yes. It is. The bank account number is an access device, and the check on the bottom, the maker line of the check, is the bank account number, so that would be an access device.
Thank you.
For the record, this is John Skidmore through the Chair, Senator French. I would concur with that anytime someone uses a bank account, that qualifies as an access device.
Thank you.
But just to be clear, I'm not talking about the use of the check. I mean just the possession, you know, that if you steal a checkbook, you've stolen an access device.
Through the chair, yes, sir. That's exactly what I mean. When you have that account number, whether it's because you have the check or whether it's because you have written down from someone's check and taken that access device with you to use that fraudulently obtain it if you have done so with the intent to defraud, then
Thank you.
If I could address that.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Through the chair, the another example of that that we had a couple of, well, maybe a year and a half ago, we had an individual that flew into Alaska from Washington State. It turned out he was visiting some friends, and he was bragging to these friends how he was into identity theft and methamphetamine. In his bag that he traveled with, his luggage, he had tons of stolen mail. In his mail, there were bank account statements. And he had different kinds of IDs. We weren't sure who he was, but we really had no other crime on him except the fact that he had stolen mail. Well, the postal inspectors were interested in the case, but there was a federal holiday was coming up, and they weren't able to arrest him without a judge, so they looked to the police department to, can you arrest this guy for something to hold him in jail? And for each bank statement that he had, there was an access device because the bank account number was on the bank statement. At that time, we were able to arrest him for a misdemeanor because he had someone's stolen bank statement. So that was, currently, stealing an access device is an A misdemeanor. This bill would make a C felony. So we had some A misdemeanors for this guy, and it's like, well, this, you know, we're waiting to charge him on a federal case, and we can charge him with his misdemeanors. So what we did was we basically counted up the statements and charged him with 37 counts of A misdemeanors in hopes that the magistrate would post a bail that would hold him in jail until the feds could take a hold of him. Whereas if we had been able to charge felonies, it would have been such a sticky situation that we were dealing with that day. And so I think when we talk about that, making this a C felony, I think it's most appropriate, and it would include the bank account number. And that's another way in which a bank account number can be stolen. And we know that a lot of identity theft is propagated through stolen mail. And if I could mention one more thing that I had forgotten, the you know, most people are considering identity theft is being perpetuated by the computer, use of the computer, all these computer hackers and compromises and intrusions into the computer. But the figures that I've read recently from different sources, anywhere from 14 to 26% of ID theft might come from computer intrusions or compromises. Most of your identity theft, the majority of it, is just the good old-fashioned way. Someone steals your wallet. A relative uses your social security number or your identifying information in order to get a job, or if they have bad credit, so they're trying to get credit, or they're trying to get a loan, or they're trying to, they don't have a driver's license because theirs was suspended, so they're giving out your information, and they're giving you a criminal record because they're giving your information every time they stop. So another thing to consider is this bill will help us crack down on and show that we're serious to the citizens of Alaska that stealing someone's access device, whether it be a credit card, a social security number, a bank account number, that we're very serious about it.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for being with us. Marie, you want to testify on this bill, did you? Are you going to hold up the passage of this bill to the next committee? Welcome, Marie. If you'll put your name on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm representing the AARP Capital City Task Force. And you should have a copy of a letter from us which says that we fully support this and are concerned, because we do know that there's been a much greater impact on seniors over the last few years on identity theft and all kinds of methods that they use for vulnerable elderly people. And that's where AARP, in fact, has started an education program called Identity Theft, and attempting to do an education program amongst the public generally as much as we can to really admonish people about the ways in which this happens and to be aware of it, and also what you should do if something like that happens. And we have done several of these already throughout the state, and there'll be more of them going on, but it goes into all the manners of identity theft that are out there and being used and that people should be aware of. But the letters that you have, and this covers both one, I mean, we have a letter for 131 and 132 also, in which we say we support this for the reason that we know that elderly people are more devastated maybe than some others by things like this that happen, either because they're on a fixed income for one thing, and they just at times don't even know what to do if something happens. And so we do really support both bills.
Okay. Any questions for Marie? Thank you for your testimony this morning. We have no one else online, and we have no one else in the audience who's indicated they want to testify on the bill, so we're going to close public testimony on this bill at this time. Discussion among the members. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 131 be moved with individual comments and physical note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill's moved to the next committee. Just a short recess. House Bill 132, and gentlemen, the same crew, come on up. Mr. Rao, are you going to take the lead on this one as well?
I'll go first. For the record, my name is Randy Raro. I'm an attorney with the Department of Law, and the Criminal Division does support House Bill 132. Crimes against the elderly are, I guess the committee's already heard some testimony, but I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, Randy, can you answer the question I had asked Representative Stoltz about whether or not we have similar enhanced penalties for the mentally disabled?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, there is an aggravator, I think, on the books for people who are particularly vulnerable, I think is the language. I'm trying to run from memory here. But I'm not sure how often it's applied or how, you know, routinely it's applied in cases. But I think there's an option there if a court, you know, wanted to look at that.
Mr. Chair, was there a reason, and either for the sponsor staff or for you, Randy, was there a reason you went with enhanced penalties versus aggravator?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, the one reported case I could find where the aggravator was tried to be used with a criminal case and an elderly person, the court seemed to ignore the aggravator and fashioned a sentence that was just within the normal range, regardless of whether the aggravator applied or not. And so we felt this was a more sure way of bringing to the court's attention that crimes against the elderly need to be particularly, looked at and dealt with.
So there is an aggravator right now for the elderly?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, I don't think it says elderly. I think it just says a person who's particularly vulnerable, and then that is...
I think it goes a little more. French. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I think it goes a little more than that. I think it says due to age, infirmity, and it may list a mental element as well. In addition to those, I think there are prongs in the sex assault statutes that make it a crime that make it a separate crime to rape a vulnerable victim in that sense, in the mental sense.
Other Questions, Mr. Senator French?
What? How does this bill jibe with Blakely? Will these elements have to be alleged in the complaint and proved to the jury?
Through the chair, Senator French, that's correct, and we did review that issue pretty thoroughly with Representative Grunberg and the Judiciary Committee. On the other side, the prosecution, if it wishes to use or seek the penalties under the bill, would have to disclose that that it's charging under these statutes, and so it would it'd be an upfront disclosure. It wouldn't be you wouldn't need a separate trial for to try to get an enhanced penalty.
But the jury would have to find that the defendant knew or should have known that the victim was over 65. That's kind of the crucial element that gets you into the higher phase of penalty.
Through the chair, Senator French, that's correct.
And did I paraphrase the mental element correctly, or do you want to make sure we're all on the...
Through the chair, Senator French, it's actually recklessly disregard. I don't know I don't believe that's equivalent to knew or should have known. Maybe there's instances where it would be, but the actual language in the bill is recklessly disregard.
Maybe you could just tell us, put on the record how a jury would be charged.
I believe
how is the court going to define reckless disregard?
Through the chair, Senator French, I believe there's a definition of reckless conduct in the statutes, and the jury would be given an instruction with that definition and told, that they would have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant acted with that mental state in committing the crime.
So it's aware of and disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the person was. I think that's recklessness.
Through the chair, Senator French, I believe you're correct.
Through the chair, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Rep. Stoltz. I have the definition if you'd want me to read it, or I can...
Go ahead.
Reckless, it's found under recklessly, and it's in statute 1181-900, section A, subsection 3. A person acts recklessly with respect to a result or to a circumstance described by a provision of law defining an offense when the person is aware and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that disregard of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. A person who is unaware of a risk of which the person would have been aware had that person not been intoxicated acts recklessly with respect to that risk.
A question, Senator French? Other questions from members? On 132, I know we have some people that would like to testify on the bill. I'm not sure that we need to have a big discussion on the bill. Is there anyone online or in the audience that wishes to testify against this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Senator French, yes.
This bill's going on to finance or another committee of referral?
Where is it going? Finance.
I don't want to speak for my seatmate, but maybe you might look at the intent and finding section. It's been at least the protocol of the member who isn't here today to look at those, and
That's correct, and I would normally allow Senator Dario to strike the intent and finding sections of the bill.
When they're not needed for legal reasons, just because of...
I think in this case, you're probably correct that we would... Senator Terrio would probably make a motion to strike the intent and finding language contained in Section 1 of the bill. Does anyone wish to make that motion?
That?
You have a problem with that?
Just through the chair, understand that that's Senator Terrio's practice, and the intent and findings of the bill aren't, a critical part of the bill. But I guess I would just note that courts in Alaska do look at the intent and findings, and will quote those occasionally in their decisions. And in this case, I think the findings are pretty short, and they, a judge looking back at it would be able to see exactly that the legislature was concerned with. So this may be an exception to his
rule, but it's not a critical part of the bill, so.
Is there a discussion?
Just on that point, Mr. Chairman, I think any court, I've been in court with a judge named Judge Souter who would sometimes lean over very carefully and say, now listen here, you three people upstairs, this is what I'm doing. And it was quite humorous, and I guess the reason I'm doing that now is I think the people who review this bill will hear us loud and clear that we believe that these crimes should be penalized more seriously because elderly victims suffer disproportionately to the normal individual. But by the same token, I guess I would encourage the committee to take the findings out, and you could quibble, I think, with finding number three, for example, that the elderly suffer physical and emotional harm from these crimes than do younger victims. That almost implies that children don't suffer as much as the elderly, and I think you could probably argue about that, and I'm not sure we've had specific evidence on that. So I think the will of the committee is clear. And
I think we are very clear that elderly people can be more vulnerable, although I don't define elderly as being over 65 at this point in my life. But not as a point on the record.
But you're willing
other
to go along with
that. Other people may be elderly. But and I think it's very clear here, too, that we are changing this penalty because we believe that it's a more heinous crime to perpetrate this kind of an action against someone who is vulnerable, more vulnerable than the general population, even though it's a growing segment of the population. So with that in mind, it's very clear that I understand the possibilities of the devastating impact that this kind of crime can have on someone who is elderly, and therefore I'm more than willing to increase the penalty for that crime. And I think by an affirmative vote from the other members of the committee and from as it gets across the floor, that intent will be pretty clear. Is there any motion on the on this section?
Mr. Chair, I'll move to strike section one of the bill.
Is there objection? Hearing none. The bill has been amended. That's amendment number one to strike the findings section number one. Senator Huggins?
Chair, I move that CS for House Bill 132 be moved from committee with, as amended, with individual comments and physical note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved to the next committee of referral. We have nothing else on our calendar this morning, and we're going to dismiss rarely for this committee, but early. Tomorrow we will have on our calendar House Bill 85 and House Bill 88 and bills previously heard and scheduled. We'll see what we can look at there.
85 and 88?
Yes. Prescribed medication for students and criminal law, minors, schools, drugs, sentences. If we see anything else that's coming up on 20, Senate Bill 20, we may hear that if we have time. I've been told by the sponsor that they have an amendment that they're crafting that they would like to bring back to us.
Mr. Chair, I've been working with the sponsor on another amendment as well, and that we're trying to get crafted, just to let you know.
On 20.
On 20.
So with that, unless there's something else, which I don't see, this committee is adjourned at 10:02.